Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Now the perfect follow-up guest to our recent oral history series about your generations and your defining news events decade by decade. It's Washington Post columnist Philip Bump, whose new book is called The Aftermath, The Last Days of the Baby Boom and the Future of Power in America. Those of you who listen regularly know that Philip comes on fairly often to talk about news and national politics of the day. What you may not know is that Philip is a data geek extraordinaire, and this book is brimming with fascinating numbers that tell the story of America going through a generational transition right now, in addition to Philip's insightful narrative about what it all means, especially for millennial and Gen Z Americans facing the challenges of leadership next. Philip, congratulations on the book, and welcome back to WNYC.
Well, thank you very much. It's very kind.
Can we start with some basic stats? How big was the baby boom that it got that nickname in the first place?
Yeah, and one of the things I discovered as I was researching the book is probably even to baby boomers, the scale of the baby boom is sort of hard to get our minds around. So the number I like to cite is when in 1945, before the boom began, there were about 140 million people in America. Over the course of the next 19 years, the period that defines this demographic shift that was the baby boom, there are more than 75 million babies born, right? So that's more than 50% of the existing population in 1945 were born as babies over the course of the next 19 years. And so the effect of that, it should be obvious, right? Instantaneously, there's a massive market for things like diapers, right? You have to build new elementary schools. And so we see this huge surge in the number of people that are being added to the United States, and then secondarily, this huge shift in what America has to do to accommodate them.
Does that mean that the Depression and World War II era Americans, what Tom Brokaw called the greatest generation in his book of that title, that they had more kids on average than their parents who had them in the 1920s or so, and the urge to procreate actually changed from one generation to the next in the 20th century?
Yeah, there were a number of factors that actually contributed to the baby boom. Landon Jones, who wrote a really great book about the baby boom back in 1980, walks through a lot of the actual factors that played into that, which is where I learned about it, essentially. But there were a number of things that sort of shifted. I mean, there was, of course, this post-World War II period. People like to think of the baby boom as being this function of soldiers returning home, and that's obviously not accurate given that it lasted 19 years. But it is the case that America was seeing this new era of prosperity, this new era of confidence that didn't exist previously. And there were lots of ways in which it was easier to become a parent than it had been in decades prior, to your point about the Great Depression. You're not having a lot of kids in the Great Depression if you can avoid it, because there's so many economic strains. In this era of huge economic prosperity, having all these kids makes a lot more sense. But then that also then helps contribute to the economic prosperity. And as such, that helps propagate the boom.
So listeners, we'll take calls for Philip Bump in two blocks. First, if you are Gen X or below, that is anyone younger than a baby boomer, how good or bad do you feel about boomers as stewards of the world during their prime years in leadership? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. We'll take boomer calls after that. But first, if you are Gen X or below, so anyone younger than a baby boomer, how good or bad do you feel about boomers as stewards of the world during their prime years in leadership? Plus, anything you want to ask Philip Bump, author of The Aftermath, The Last Days of the Baby Boom and the Future of Power in America. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. So, Philip, there's a stereotype of an American baby boomer. It's probably of a white, liberal college student who protested the war in Vietnam, right, and smoked pot long before it was sold in dispensaries.
Right.
But sure, that would miss the diversity of experience within the generation. And I know you get into this based on race and class and education and other right, defining things. So can you start to paint a next level deep portrait of what the baby boomer demographics really were?
Yeah, certainly. And I think the best way to consider who the baby boom was to remember that the baby boom really defines what America is in this moment, right? That the baby boom, not only through sheer scale and population, but really reshaped America as it as it grew older, simply because we had to accommodate all of these new Americans. But it just the baby boomers make such a large percentage of America for so long that when we think about the baby boom, it's just fair to think generally about the ways in which America itself is diverse. I think one of the reasons that the perception of the baby boom has shifted is because the baby boom does look different than younger Americans in really, really key ways, particularly around racial diversity. And so I think that this perception that we have currently of baby boomers as being heavily white, which is accurate, it is a much more densely white generation than generations that followed. I think part of that is simply because we have this heightened difference between older and younger. But you're right. The baby boom itself is a huge group of people that has all sorts of political views, all sorts of economic levels. You know, there's this perception that baby boomers are wealthy because baby boomers hold so much aggregated wealth. But of course, there's a lot of baby boomers. And so on average, the average baby boomer is no wealthier than anyone else. It's just that the baby boom collectively has all of this wealth because there are so many of them. And they, of course, are also subject to the same sorts of disparities in wealth equality that the rest of the country has. And so there is also, when we talk about the tensions, which, you know, obviously the book focuses on, there's also this tension within the boom itself, where boomers are cast as this very wealthy generation, but a lot of boomers are not particularly wealthy. And, one can imagine how you could grow resentful as a result of that.
And I can make an argument that when you correct for more enduring differences, generation largely disappears. The zip code you were born into in our segregated society says a lot more about who you will be economically and culturally than whether you're a boomer or below. But is that what the research shows?
Yeah, no, that's broadly accurate, correct. But of course, then there are other confounding factors like race. And so when we talk about the fact that baby boomers are much more homogeneously white than our subsequent generations, then we have to consider what the advantages of being white mean when it comes to economics and, of course, what it means for political views. Yes, you're absolutely right, that not only is there a lot of sort of economic predetermination baked into who you are, from a very early age, not insurmountable, but obviously it's there. But we also see one of the things that's happened over the course of the baby boomers' lifetimes is we've seen this increased siloization of where people live and who they live near that then contributes to a lot of the partisan tensions that we have simply because people don't live near a lot of people or socialize with a lot of people who don't share their own views. And so there are a lot of ways in which you're absolutely right, where you're born and who you were, what family you're born into dictates who you became to a significant extent. But then there are also ways in which that has been exacerbated by the choices that have been made over those decades.
Let's take a phone call. Erica in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Erica.
Oh, hi, wonderful. I have a very brief thing to say, which is I feel terribly about their stewardship as leaders. I feel that generation has been kind of narcissistic, is like the brief word that I think says it all. And been a major player in troubles with the environment that we're now facing, and it's fed by their kind of narcissism and selfish, me first kind of mentality.
Erica, thank you very much. We'll get a reaction to that in a minute. Let's go to another caller first. Peter in Mattawan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What are you thinking?
I guess the whole question is of I was born in 1970. I'm 52 years old. So I guess I'm that classic Gen X cohort. And my impression when I was kind of going through college and getting out of college in the early 90s, because, you know, there was that whole, you know, 60s nostalgia thing. And I always felt like people who were able to be people who would be baby boomers were always had a lot more of a rosier optimism because they always had a decent job. They always had no problems. Where like a lot of people my age had like divorced parents, or my mom's an immigrant. So like a lot of those people had like a lot of people in Gen X had like silent generation parents. Mm-hmm. So you couldn't necessarily be as carefree about certain things. So I think a lot of people in my age group kind of did the sort of slacker thing because it was just a way to kind of decompress from having divorced parents or decompress from certain situations, because there's a lot more of a downbeat vibe. I mean, there is a reason why there's that whole grungy downbeat thing. But we always had to work. That's the funny thing. Like I kind of heard the earlier call in the earlier segment, how he's a 57-year-old guy and he made it through the tech boom because he just knows that all he could depend on was himself. So a lot of people in our age group had to be self-reliant and not as happy-go-lucky, whereas the previous generation, baby boom generation, people say of like President Clinton's cohort, could afford to be all peace and love. I think that's a key difference.
That's really interesting. Yeah. So that's quite a contrast, Philip, between the first two calls.
Right.
Peter there saying that because times were better economically for baby boomers than for Gen Xers later, they could afford to be all peace and love and idealistic. And Erica, the first caller, was saying, no, the baby boomers did not leave me such a great world because they weren't idealistic enough. They were bad to the climate and they were narcissistic.
Yeah, so I think that those things overlap in perhaps some unexpected ways. So when we talk about climate change, for example, it is the case that about 20% of all of global carbon dioxide emissions occurred in the United States during the period when the baby boomers were alive, between 1946 and 2020, according to my analysis in the book. That's a significant effect on climate change, and it's a reason that climate change is now such a salient issue in American politics. And that, by itself, helps contribute to some of the generational tension that we see, because baby boomers, for the baby boom generation, there was not a huge focus on climate change. It was not something that was as present in the scientific conversation, much less the political conversation. And so now we see differences among younger Americans who are focused on things like LGBTQ rights and climate change that were not issues that were even focused on, particularly to a large extent by baby boomer liberals, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And so we see this intergenerational political tension that stems simply from the fact that politics themselves have changed, which I think speaks to the first point. To the second point on optimism, it's absolutely the case that the baby boomers at the outset were born into an America, as I said before, that's very wealthy. But it's also the case that the baby boom was a focus of a lot of attention, right? You know, by virtue of scale, the United States had to figure out how to accommodate this generation. And so there was, you know, I previously mentioned Landon Jones in his 1980 book, but he spoke with baby boomers and they were just sort of like, it took them a while to realize it was exceptional, the amount of attention they were getting, right? And I think that I, too, as a member of Generation X, was sort of able to understand like, okay, like I can see how we are in a different position than were our parents. But there's also a very practical side to that. There is research that shows that Americans today, Americans in post-baby boom generations, are less likely to earn the same sort of income as their parents did, even adjusted over time, simply because the economy has changed. And so, you know, there are reasons also for us to be a little bit more skeptical, a little bit more wary than the boomers were when they were in their prime.
Linda in Sparta, you're on WNYC. Hi, Linda.
Hello. Thank you for having me on. I'm a millennial. I was a Chinese American immigrant. I immigrated to the United States when I was four from Beijing, China. And I do feel like my parents have passed on a great work ethic as baby boomers who immigrated here. I do feel somewhat of a pressure to continue that, you know, optimism and the prosperity mindset going forward. I was just diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer last week. So it's been kind of a ride. I do feel optimistic, probably because I don't know if I have any other option really at this point. But I think there's definitely, you know, mental health has always somewhat been an issue that was never addressed by my parents. They just kept on working and working hard. And I know that's a huge issue for my generation currently and the younger generation.
Do you think that your parents as Chinese immigrants fit into a framework of American baby boomers generally, if we can call it that, or is their experience largely different because of their immigrant experience?
I think their experience is definitely different. They've never taken anything for granted and have always worked hard for whatever they've really come up against, you know, any negative experiences. That being said, you know, it's definitely an uphill battle as you know, immigrants and like working hard and not having a network here. So as the next generation, I don't know if that informs my perspective as a millennial. Like I just kind of keep going.
I guess I'm wondering, did your parents ever say anything about born here baby boomers and how they're similar or different to or from them? You know what I mean?
I think so. There's definitely a greater sense of prosperity, I think, or just being able to make mistakes and not have to pay as much of a consequence for them. I think being immigrants here, we don't have that luxury. We don't have that safety net. And I think that's something that's been well communicated. Yeah. Linda, thank you very much.
I hope you're well and call us again. Robert in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Robert.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Thank you for taking my call. My point, one of my thoughts was that when we talk about the baby boomers and their years, their primary years in power, their prime years in power, I don't know how far out of that we necessarily are, because we still see basically a gerontocracy in Congress and politics. And then you also still see it in terms of the rate of construction of things like retirement homes and communities and nursing homes and things like that, and the rate at which new construction is popping up is largely driven by that generation. I also wonder if the rate of population growth was just too much for our economic and political systems to handle, because it's not like there were all the bad boomers were, you know, it was completely responsible for the climate situation we're in now, but it seems sort of like unchecked economic and political systems that had never had to be checked by that point allowed it to get to this point.
Robert, thank you. Very insightful points. And he touches on a number of things that you explore in depth in the book, Philip. So where do you want to enter?
I want to enter by talking about building retirement homes, right? Because he's absolutely right. And again, we have to think about the fact that the baby boom over the course of the boom has seen this pattern. They get to be kindergarten age, you got to start building kindergartens. They enter the workforce. What are you going to do with all that? We don't have enough jobs. That's why we see an increase in college education, even among baby boomers. That helps contribute to things like the Vietnam War draft. You have all of these kids who have just graduated from high school. Like, there are all these ways which over the course of time, the baby boomers had to be accommodated. And now, and you know, part of the point of the book is we forget that the baby boom is so big and it is now reaching this point. I spoke with a woman who works for the retirement home industry, and they've been watching this coming for decades, and they're stoked, right? Because finally, this is their moment to benefit from the baby boom's arrival. So yes, we're absolutely seeing that. But it is also the case, yes, that the baby boom still wields disproportionate power relative to generations, simply because there are so many of them and because they have a unique set of needs. At the same time, you have the millennials in particular coming up behind them, a generation that is almost as large numerically, although not as a percentage of the population. And they are making a different set of demands. They are saying, we need things like housing. We need things like childcare. And you have a group of boomers that is very, very large, votes much more heavily, and is helping make decisions about what happens. That said, we do see some transfers of power. We see, for example, that Nancy Pelosi and the leadership of the Democratic Party chooses to step down in favor of younger representatives, in part, of course, because the Democrats lost the House, but in part because the Democratic Party recognizes that they have a much larger constituency of younger people that they need to do a better job of representing. And so we see things like that. Yes, it is the case the boomers still wield disproportionate power. It is, however, the case that there are starting to be these shifts, these downward generational shifts. And just very quickly to the first caller, the fact that we're talking about her as an immigrant and a child of an immigrant family is really important. The baby boom started at a lull in American immigration. Immigration was still restricted because of the anti-immigrant backlash about a century ago. It didn't open up until after the baby boom. And so the baby boom is a much less densely immigrant-heavy population than other generations simply because of that factor. And so that's a key differentiator between them and younger Americans as well.
Well, in fact, the current moral panic, if I can call it that, over migrants coming across the southern border, I think obscures the fact that our country is economically stronger than some in Europe or than Japan, because as all of these wealthy industrialized countries see declining birth rates, and we have too, we have had a lot of immigration, keeping our worker to retiree ratio healthier than many of the others. I'm curious if you accept that as an economic premise. It sounds like you do. And does it play generationally into your book? Because I could argue that the liberalized immigration law of 1965 is as big a factor as anything else in New York's success and America's success the last 50 years. But some would also argue it contributes to making the decline in wages possible that we heard from the Gen X caller, and any caller younger than him would also say, because immigrants have less organizing power in the workplace. So does your research get into any of that?
It does, as a matter of fact. And in fact, I just wrote a piece recently for the Washington Post about when we talk about the decline in China's population size that happened this year, the way in which we can compare that to the United States and how the United States doesn't see a similar decline because of immigration. If you speak to demographers, one of the things they will point to you is the is concern about this gap between the number of older Americans who will potentially need either direct explicit medical care, for example, or will at the very least need to be rely on systems that depend upon taxes being paid by working Americans, mm-hmm. and the number of people who are within the workforce. You see this shift. You see this. There's been a spike essentially over the past 20 years as boomers have started to retire. Boomers now make up most retirees in America. You've seen this shift in this ratio, and this is concerning to demographers. And if you ask those demographers what a solution is, they will often point to immigration. Bring more people into the country. Have more people fill these jobs. There is research that looks at this question of the extent to which the increase in immigration affects wages. There's a really good national study that was done several years ago that found that there were some communities in which an increase in immigration can tamp down on wages, but those were often communities that were already highly that had a lot of immigrants, that there was not a profound effect broadly on the American economy, according to this. This was, I think, done through the National Science Foundation, something along those lines. So, yes, there is lots of research on this. Demographers will absolutely point to immigration as a key asset that the United States has in trying to fend off this sort of demographic decline.
All right. We've taken some calls from people younger than baby boomers. Now I'll flip the script and open the phones to baby boomers to answer the same question. How good or bad do you feel about your boomer generation as stewards of the world during your prime years in leadership? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Everybody else who's younger, if you're still holding on, thanks for waiting, but we couldn't get to all of your calls, and we're going to flip the board here. Now it's four baby boomers, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Respond to any of the younger callers who we were just listening to, or give us your own take on how your generation has done as stewards of the world during your prime years in leadership, or anything you want to ask Philip Bump. Questions are okay too. Philip Bump, author of The Aftermath, The Last Days of the Baby Boom, and The Future of Power in America. Your calls or tweet at Brian Lehrer, and we'll continue with all of that right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we continue with Washington Post columnist Philip Bump, the author now of The Aftermath, The Last Days of the Baby Boom, and The Future of Power in America. Before we take some more phone calls, Philip, you see what you call generational sniping as a function of the baby boomers not being as numerically daunting anymore and therefore vulnerable to challenges to their power. But when you refer to generational sniping, what is the sniping usually about?
Yeah, and I think that's obviously true, since that's what I argue. But I also think that it's important to recognize that the sniping is enabled by the fact that younger Americans can be heard in a way that wasn't possible 50 years ago, right? So you have things like, this great quote that I point to from a PR guy who's talking to Harper's a couple of years ago, and he said that, you can be sitting in your bedroom in Cleveland, get 1 million followers overnight. You can see people have a massive effect on people's awareness of what's happening in the world that wasn't possible. So you can have millennial and Gen Z Americans raise issues and confront the baby boom generation in a way that didn't used to be possible. And I think exacerbates tension, particularly for baby boomers who are very used to being the center of attention and very used to wielding this power and getting their way and being the dominant thing that America talks about. So to answer your question directly, the sorts of things that we often hear about are housing in particular, right? That the younger Americans are less able to afford housing. And this is sort of portrayed and intermixed with politics, that this is seen as something conservative. But it's also just important to contextualize in the scale of the baby boom. Baby boomers own houses. Many baby boomers who own houses see those houses as a storehouse of value that will be useful to them once they retire. They look to protect that storehouse of value. And so then they, often with more time in our hands, can participate in public meetings and go and say, hey, we don't think this new housing should be built, out of concern that that'll diminish their own property values. But then the downstream effects of that are that younger people have less access to affordable housing. And so there are a lot of things like that where the baby boom is making decisions not you know, collectively, they're not all standing around and voting saying we don't want any new housing, but individually are making decisions that are comparable to one another at a massive scale that advantage a particular type of person, a particular age group of person, that then disadvantages younger people.
But is it even in the remaining baby boomers' interest? Like, one of the things from your book, if I'm characterizing this right, is that if many boomers have their wealth tied up in the value of their homes and they need to cash out and downsize to pay for their own senior care, they need younger families to sell their homes too. There's a mismatch there, but is it really the boomers deciding not to build enough new housing, or what contributes to that shortage that we grapple with really every day on this show in terms of a current issue of the housing shortage?
Right. And obviously, it's a very complex thing that can't just be reduced to one thing. But it is the case that not necessarily boomers as such, but homeowners broadly wield disproportionate power in determining what happens in many places when new housing projects are offered. There was some fascinating research that's elevated in the book that looked at, that compared who was actually going to public meetings to discuss housing, what they were saying, and what their backgrounds were. And they found that these were predominantly homeowners. And one of the fascinating aspects of that research was that they considered both before and after the pandemic. So when these meetings moved to Zoom, and theoretically people who worked jobs or people who, you know, might otherwise not have been able to attend the meetings could just simply log in from home, they looked to see if that sort of liberalized the group of people that was responding. And it didn't. Uh-huh. It was still homeowners who had the stake, who had more
interest. And so if it's private homeowners largely who oppose the density that the political leaders say we need to have enough supply to meet the demand for affordable housing, then another way to look at that is generational, because that's who owns the private homes.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And this is not a small issue nationally either. There was research that was done that showed between, I think it was 1964 and 2009, had there been more housing in about 220 metropolitan areas in the United States, the American economy would have been almost a third larger. That there was the economy was hampered by that extent by this lack of housing nationally over that period. And so, you know, this is not simply something millennials are worried about. This is something broadly that can be potentially damaging the economy.
A few more minutes with Philip Bump from The Washington Post, and now author of The Aftermath, The Last Days of the Baby Boom and the Future of Power in America. And we took some younger than baby boomer callers. Let's take some boomer callers now. Helene in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Helene.
Hi, Brian. I love your show, and I listen to it whenever I can. And I just have a very quick comment to make, which is that earlier on, one of the younger people talked about baby boomers being selfish and not being interested in climate change. And I just want to remind your listeners that baby boomers were on the forefront of marches and movements for social justice and for cleaner water and cleaner air. And we did manage to change the politics in that respect in a small way. And that's just a comment, and I'm happy to take any comments off the air.
Thank you very much. Let me go through a little set of callers here. We'll go to Ellen in Park Slope next. Hi, Ellen. You're on WNYC.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to push back against the characterization of the baby boomer generation as being all hippies and about free love. We were a tough generation. I was born in 1950. I grew up ducking and covering under my desk in elementary school because of the, you know, imminent threat of nuclear disaster. The city was pocketed with air raid shelters. In junior high, that was elementary school. In junior high school, I was sent home to die with my family because of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Mm-hmm. And then 2 years later, sent home because of the JFK assassination. My college erupted after the Martin Luther King assassination. We were characterized by a string of and the Vietnam War was a reason for massive demonstrations constantly. We were also the generation that had to react to Barry Goldwater's comment that the, extremism and the defense of liberty was no vice. So, and which is sort of seeing the fruit of that now in the extreme right wing. There was a lot of fun. I mean, I went to incredible rock concerts. And I enjoy seeing headlines that refer to rock songs in all the newspapers because my generation is still in charge of certain things. But to characterize us as carefree and always prosperous is, I think, a misnomer.
Ellen, thank you very much. Let's go to Wanda in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi, Wanda.
Hi. I just wanted to say that some of the characterizations of boomers, I am a boomer, I don't even recognize. The idea that the concept that we were wealthy, I have never owned a house in my life, never been able to own a house in my life. I have 4 degrees. We were the people, at least in my group, we were the people who cared about issues, somewhat like the previous caller stated, that cared about issues more than money. We were, you know, pushing the envelope of the existing establishment of our time.
Though it depended who and when, right? Because by the time we got to the 1980s, baby boomers voted mostly for Ronald Reagan. And then, yes, they voted mostly for Clinton, but then they voted mostly for George W. Bush. And, oh, by the way, for Trump in 2016.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I think that what the callers raise absolutely valid points, which is that when we talk about the baby boom, it is a large and varied group of people. That is absolutely the case. It is, however, also the case that a lot of baby boomers do own houses, you know, that they are able to afford houses at some point in their lives. It is not the case that all baby boomers were carefree and prosperous. It is, however, the case that the baby boom emerged at a time when the country broadly was prosperous and the economy was very good, and that there were possibilities that were more limited for other generations. So, yes, the callers raised totally valid points. That is the case that individual baby boomers did not experience the sort of collective benefits that the baby boom itself did, and that there were these moments of immense trauma. That's absolutely the case. But none of that diminishes the fact that the baby boom, again, speaking collectively, had a different experience than other generations. And I do want to highlight one point from the last caller who said that they were the ones pushing back against the establishment at the time. That's absolutely right. They were. They broke the establishment, both by virtue of activism and by virtue of scale. And then they became the establishment, to your point, Brian. And now they are the ones who have for so long been driving. You know, they began driving what America was doing well before their parents did by virtue of scale. And now they are the ones driving what America is doing. And part of what we're seeing in the moment is a backlash to that from a new, rising, large, younger generation of people.
One more boomer call. Neil in Plainfield. You're on WNYC. Hi, Neil.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. It's always a pleasure to listen to you and pleasure to talk to you. I am so disappointed in my generation. I was in college in the late 60s and early 70s, and I thought our generation was going to change the world. And in reality, we didn't. If anything, we've made it worse. You look at politics today, which is pretty much driven mostly by the boomers at this point, how fractious it is. You look at the economy and how unfair it is to lower income people and people of color. It's just, you know, things are, while there are certainly things that are better, civil rights are certainly an improvement, things like that. The overall trajectory is just, it's negative. And I'm just so disappointed. We were so idealistic, and it's a bummer.
Do you have a theory, Neil, as to why it changed?
No, I wish I did. If I had a reason.
Yes, go ahead.
I would maybe have some of the solution, but yeah. I do think that a lot of us did become much more selfish than we thought we were.
Neil, thank you. Thank you very much. So, Philip, let's end on this. Coming out of that call, do you see a multi-generational political trend in any direction? Is each generation getting progressively more progressive? Or do we see a recurring pattern of progressive when young, more conservative when you get older, and you have more of a stake in the economy or whatever the status quo is at that time? Is there a multi-generational trend that transcends that? Or do you think, based on all your research, that we're just seeing these cycles of politics based on age?
The way I always answer questions along those lines of what politics is going to look like, particularly given that younger Americans are so much more heavily Democratic than our older Americans, is by pointing out that we really don't have a long period of social science research or polling to look at to answer this question. And polling itself is not terribly old. Social science research that's really robust and reliable isn't that old. And so it's sort of hard to say in the United States the extent to which it is true, this idea that you get more conservative as you age. Certainly it is the case with many baby boomers that that happened to them. There's also very good research that shows that a lot of people's political views are formed at a fairly young age, 14 to 24, somewhere in that age range, based in large part on who's president at the time, that that actually correlates to later partisanship. But I think the central question here, and one of the central questions of the book, is what does it mean that younger Americans are so much more diverse than older Americans? I don't think it's safe to assume, for example, that even if it were the case that younger Americans become more conservative as they get older, you know, assuming there's some, you know, non-malleable definition of conservative, which I also think isn't the case, but assuming that that was the pattern that existed, I don't think we can assume that about this generation simply because they're so much more diverse. There's so many more of them who are Hispanic or Asian or Black than was the case for baby boomers and other older generations. And so I think that any expectation we have ought to be set aside simply by virtue of the fact that America has changed demographically to the extent that we just simply see these groups that, you know, at all age groups vote much more heavily Democratic than do other Americans. We see that this is being the next group of people that's going to become that older generation. And I think that sort of throws everything out the window.
Philip Baum, Washington Post columnist. His new book is The Aftermath, The Last Days of the Baby Boom and the Future of Power in America. Philip, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.